This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Archaeology. It's part science, part history. Archaeologists use the tools of geology, forensic science, and historical study to extract meaning from artifacts. But some of the most important and interesting aspects of past cultures are intangible, even ethereal. So how can physical pieces of the past be translated into an understanding of things like music, politics, or social values? That's the challenge that our guests today have taken on. Later this hour, we'll talk with music archaeologist John Franklin and illustrator Glynis Fox about their studies and reinterpretations of ancient music and artifacts. But first, I'm joined by Joan Breton Connolly, a classical archaeologist, professor of classics and art history at New York University, and director of the Uranisos Island Excavations and Field School in Cyprus. Her work has challenged long-held ideas about the role of women in ancient Greece, and in 1996, Connolly was awarded a MacArthur Fellowship. Her new book is The Parthenon Enigma, A New Understanding of the West's Most Iconic Building and the People Who Made It. Joan Breton Connolly, welcome to Living Lab.
Thank you. Lovely to be here.
Now, first, refresh all of our memories. What is it that has been our, I guess, long-held interpretation of the Parthenon that you've kind of been working against? What were we starting from in terms of our understanding of the Parthenon?
Since the 18th century, the Parthenon has stood as a paragon of perfection in architecture, a sort of pinnacle of aesthetic beauty in sculpture, and above all, a representation of the embodiment of the birth of democracy. We have tended to look at it through the political lens, through the secular lens, as opposed to the religious lens, for what it was, a deeply sacred space. And so there has been a tendency, particularly in that 525-meter-long sculpted frieze that wraps around the colonnade, to see it as an expression of the body politic, a 4th of July parade, the citizens marching in their annual festival. What I am saying is that it has to do with religion.
Well, and so what was that understanding, that secular and political understanding of the Parthenon based on?
Well, first of all, it's based on the time of the Enlightenment. It's based on a moment in which the realization of the individual and the individual's relationship to political systems was coming into the fore. When you have something as beautiful and iconic as the Parthenon is, there is a tendency first to be drawn to it, then to see yourselves in it. And so it's this, what I call the magnet and mirror dynamic. You're drawn to it, and then you want to see yourself reflected back in it. So it's reading the Parthenon through the lens of our own times, or in the case of the Enlightenment, through their eyes, and projecting onto it who we are instead of listening to it and trying to hear who they were.
Okay, so tell me about your reinterpretation of that frieze. As you said, you view it as a religious expression, and really your interpretation has been called revolutionary. It's completely different than the traditional interpretation that we had, as you said, this annual parade, and that right in the center of it, there's a man holding a large cloth, and that's been interpreted as, I guess, a new dress, essentially, for Athena, and you say that's completely wrong.
I don't say it's completely wrong. No, I don't. I say that what we're looking at is the myth behind which the historical cult practice was based. That is, ritual behavior does not exist without myth behind it. And so what I'm saying is we're looking at something that happened in the very distant past. We have an anomaly in the Parthenon frieze. That is, all other Greek temples are decorated with scenes from myth, not from reality. And since the 15th century, it has been believed that the Parthenon frieze is a snapshot of 5th century Athenians, the very people who made the temple and worshipped at it. A kind of Periclean selfie, if you were. This notion goes against the way Greeks used images. They used images to show what can no longer be seen. You don't need to show the present because you can see the present. What you need to show, you need to access a past that is gone. So images enable you to do this. The Parthenon frieze has stood outside of all other Greek temples. It's an anomaly. When you hit an anomaly in science, something is wrong. Either we've got it wrong or a red flag, something hugely unusual is happening. The problem was we didn't have a myth to fit those images. Now we do.
So what is that myth?
Well, this is a myth that we were aware of, but we didn't have a full understanding of until the 1960s. That is the story of Erechtheus, an early king of Athens, who, when the first marauding band of barbarians came and surrounded the Acropolis, he went to the Delphic Oracle, as all good kings would do, and said, "How can I save my city?" The Delphic Oracle says, "You must sacrifice your youngest daughter." A dark answer. Erechtheus goes to his wife, Queen Praxithea. "What could we do? We must sacrifice our daughter." And his wife makes one of the most stirring, patriotic, civic-minded speeches in all of Greek drama. And it's preserved in this newly recovered text. When I say newly, 1960s. In the archaeology business, that's fairly new. Queen Praxithea says, "Of course I give my child to die for the city. No one family, not even the royals, should put itself above the common good."
And she has been credited with saying essentially that equating the practice of virgin sacrifices with the practice of men going to war, that essentially that was what women could do for the city-state.
Exactly. Just as boys go to war, girls go to the altar of sacrifice. And this enables them to become heroes. Within the context of Greek thought, a hero is someone who dies and then receives cult honors forever after. So how can women be heroic? Women cannot, within the parameters of behavior, be on the front lines of battle in ancient Greece. We cannot expect this of them. But what is so beautiful about this vehicle of virgin sacrifice, if I may say so, is that it is empowering. It enables a woman to be an equal savior of her city by making the ultimate sacrifice.
Now, when you came to this interpretation, as you've alluded to, it was based on this a text of a play that was found, I guess, wrapped up with a mummy, and as you said, had just been recently discovered. So how was that discovery made, and then how did you begin to connect the myth in that play with the frieze in the Parthenon?
Well, in fact, the mummy was excavated in 1901 in Egypt, in the near the Fayum Oasis. The mummies were brought to Paris. They sat there till the 1960s, when a professor, André Bataille, devised a method for how to put these mummy casings in a steam bath. Now, these casings are papier-mâché. When we think of mummy casings today, we think of King Tut and the golden sarcophagus. But your average men and women could not afford such luxurious coffins. And so theirs were made of papier-mâché, which was discarded text, scrap paper. And when the scribes at Alexandria were rewriting text, no Xerox machines in the time, and this is how you get text, somebody rewrites it, they naturally made errors. When they made an error on a papyrus, a valuable commodity, they threw it in the recycle bin. The recycle bin was taken to the morticians. The morticians glued these pieces of scrap paper together into coffins and then painted them and even gilded them. They're quite beautiful. So by steam bathing these papier-mâché casings in dilute hydrochloric acid and water, this method was devised in the 60s of how to peel apart the papyrus layers without damaging the ink. And we get, in this case, 130 new lines of this lost play by Euripides. We had already had about 120 from various authors, lines of the text. Now we have 250, enough to really tell us what the story is. So I had been aware of this text in 1991. I'd been carrying it around, a bad Xerox of the Greek, fragmentary Greek. There were no trots at the time, no English translations. It was tough going. And for the better part of 6 months, whenever I had a couple free hours, I would work at a line or two because it was so challenging. And later that summer, I was working on that scene in the middle of the Parthenon for a totally different project. I was working on my book on Greek priestesses, and I needed to figure out why the woman in the middle of that scene is not carrying a temple key, which is the single identifying attribute always shown in the hands of priestesses. So I was puzzling over another anomaly. Why, if this woman, as has always been said, is the priestess of Athena, the historical priestess, why doesn't she hold her attribute? And suddenly it just came to me that I was looking at what Euripides was talking about in his fragmentary play. Five individuals, a man, a woman, and three girls, in the middle of the frieze, above the door, the most important place, the founding family of Athens.
That, I mean, a fabulous eureka moment, essentially, which is so rare in study, a stroke of luck almost, although obviously the result of a lot of hard work. But it also seems in some ways, you know, you've got these very small fragments, and you've got one play, and you've got one picture, and you're trying to put together a whole story from that. How do you fill that out and still ensure that the broader interpretations you come to are something rigorous and something trustworthy and not just a great leap of faith?
Well, for starters, you have to immerse yourself in all of the evidence of the ancient past. I mean, what had happened here, the evidence was sitting there available, but in principle, people that work on new papyrological discoveries don't think about Greek architectural sculpture, and the people that are working on the architectural sculpture of the Parthenon are not reading new developments in papyrology. So what we need to do, it's like working a crime scene. You collect every bit of evidence. And so if you read all literature, 10, 20 years either side of anything you're working on, and you can do that. There's not that much surviving Greek literature. You can read it all, but you've got to read all of it, things that don't seem relevant to what you're working on. But immerse yourself in the period, eat, drink, and sleep it. Look at all the archaeological evidence, material, culture, texts, inscriptions, the works. Then you can create, we can never nail it. We can never get back into an ancient head. But I do believe that we can set up parameters within which ancient experience occurred. Now, those parameters might be quite broad in certain circumstances and quite narrow in others. As I tell my students, the single most important thing we bring to our research is an open mind. Everything is important, every scrap of DNA.
Now, when you published this reinterpretation for your scientific colleagues, for your archaeology colleagues in 1995, how was it received? I mean, this was bucking almost 200 years of conventional wisdom.
Yes, and I think it came as a great shock to many people. If we go back 1996, actually, it was a time in which we had become very accustomed to looking at the frieze through the lens, as I said, of politics, history, civic secularness, even. But what I was doing is mytho-religious, and that was not part of the usual approach at the time. So those who, of course, had books in print or articles in print of their own view of the Parthenon upholding the Orthodox view, of course, they were more upset by it than people who hadn't published their own treatment of the frieze itself. So there was definitely some pushback. But I would say amongst people who look more broadly across interdisciplinary, across the ancient world, people that are historians, but also more importantly, historians of ritual, cult, religion, performance, emotion, whole new fields of study. This is very plausible when looked at through these lenses. In the past 20 years, the study of Greek religion has burgeoned in our universities. There's a whole generation of young people coming up who think through the mytho-religious lens. For them, now, it seems extraordinarily plausible, and it's not such a shock. So I think there's been a sea change. That is a good one. That is thanks to the fact that the study of ancient religion and motion and thought and feelings is coming to the fore.
Why do you think it is so important? You know, I think traditionally archaeology has been about, to some degree, you go and you perform a dig in some site and you're trying to figure out maybe what kinds of tools people were using or how they were decorating their wares. You know, these much more tangible things. And what you're talking about is really trying to understand, as you said, the culture and the emotion, these completely intangible and in some ways unknowable things about people of the past. Why is it so important that we understand those?
Well, we need to move beyond the study of the past being a data dump. You can find the artifacts, catalog them, list them, and put them out there. But the glue that holds them together, their relationship to one another, that is our work as humanists. It's to recover the experience of the ancients who made it, their intentionality in making this and how they lived with it. Now, this is, to be sure, skating off into thin ice. We cannot access that. What I've tried to point out in this book is that we tend to create, whether we like it or not, nothing is objective. Subjectivity exists even in the description of an ancient artifact. Even when you're trying to be cold and utterly objective, you are not. And we tend to see ourselves in it. We tend to bring the baggage of our own period and project it onto the object. If you read everything, if you look at all inscriptions, if you try to immerse yourself and look at it from their perspective, you can skate onto that thin ice, and I think that you must. You must look at that glue that held the world together. The earth doesn't lie. As a field archaeologist, and I think that those who bring the experience of 30 years of digging to whatever they study are different from those that have studied it from a library perspective alone. That is, digging keeps you humble. Every summer, I dig something that had I not found it with my own hands, I would not have believed in it. It didn't fit my paradigm. It didn't fit my preconceived catalog, my structure for how to understand this. And so I realize how little we really know. And I go into the field with one paradigm, and then I find evidence that disproves it, and I have to abandon it. Great. I abandon it. On to the next. This is how science moves forward. New data generates new results, and you've got to test what you used to believe against all emerging new data. That's all I've done here. I've taken an old paradigm, 230 years old, and we have a responsibility to bring new evidence to bear and say, does this still hold up?
Now, when you have a scientist working in, say, the natural or the physical scientist, there are protocols to enforce rigor and objectivity, because of course we are human, and it's easy to lose your objectivity. How do you do that in archaeology? I mean, you're not performing an experiment. You can't make it a double-blind situation. How do you try to maintain your objectivity when you're describing these new things and try to divorce yourself from your own sensibilities and your own cultural heritage?
Well, the beauty of archaeology is that it is inherently a team effort. And so the dynamics of discovery, I view my excavations in Cyprus as my lab, and I have a real need to be in my lab every season with my collaborators. And so, we have a team of diverse minds, and they include, physical anthropologists, they include forensic scientists who do the, carbon-14 and the DNA testing. We have architects using laser theodolites. We have scientists. We have historians. And we bounce ideas off of one another. There is a checks and balances. It is a meeting of the minds. It is not one person imposing their view onto the material. It's a lifelong discussion. I called a summit in 2002, and I brought all the people that had ever worked on my dig, and I said, what's going on here? I have mapped out six scenarios, and we're going to, for a three-day period, argue each one of them. And then at the end, we're going to say which one stands up from all points of view. So I think it is the nature of the team, and this is what's beautiful about archaeology. It is not an isolated endeavor. It is one in which you constantly need to bounce ideas off and build on the works of your collaborators.
Now, you've started bringing, as well as a variety of different kinds of scientists or historians to your digs, you've started bringing contemporary artists onto your dig sites. What has that been like, and what do you get out of that experience of having an artist there next to you as you're performing a dig?
Well, again, we get to see what we're doing through the eyes of someone that is seeing things we don't see. So last summer was terribly exciting. For the first time, I brought a video artist local from Paphos. And he spent some days with us following the earth, from the scraping of the earth to putting it through the sieve and the shaking of it and the movement of it and the buckets and the dump. And he had worked as a kind of earth artist and had a sort of angle from this point of view. And he made an observation that I, you know, we're so deep into it, we can't see ourselves. And he said, working with you over these days has been like being in church. And I said, what? He said, well, you're all up here. You're on your knees. You're scraping lovingly. You're silent. You're looking, you know, we look for a change in the texture, the color, the quality, the density, the packedness of the earth. And so we're thinking as we dig, we're reflecting. And he found it contemplative. He found it sort of thoughtful, quiet. He found it very moving spiritually. We don't see
it. It's almost a meditation.
A meditation, exactly. Which, in fact, it is. But if an outsider doesn't come and tell you that, you don't see what you're going through. And maybe that's part of the pull. I mean, for us, this island now in our 25th year, going into our 24th this season, I know every corner of it, that earth. And it is like a reverence. It's a reverence that you bring to it. And you need it. You have a longing for it. You need to go back.
Joan Breton Connolly, New York University professor, MacArthur Fellow, and author of The Parthenon Enigma, A New Understanding of the West's Most Iconic Building and the People Who Made It. Joan, thank you.
Thank you.
Joan will rejoin us later this hour. In just a moment, we'll talk with music archaeologist John Franklin and archaeological illustrator Glynis Fox. That's after a short break. Stay with us. You're listening to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. We're talking this hour about the archaeology of ancient culture, how we investigate the intangible aspects of ancient life, and what it means for our modern lives. Joining me now in our Woods Hole studio is Glynis Fox, an artist, cartoonist, and archaeological illustrator who has worked on excavations in Cyprus, Greece, and the Middle East. She's drawn comic versions of the Homeric hymns to Aphrodite, Demeter, and Dionysus. And a Fulbright scholarship resulted in two books, one of paintings and another of cartoons about Cypriot archaeology. Also here, John Franklin. He's an associate professor of classics at the University of Vermont. He combines his expertise in music composition, electronic music, and classics to not only study, but reconstruct and even remix ancient music. John, Glynis, welcome to Living Lab.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Now, before the break, Joan was talking about this kind of synergy that happens when you have an artist on the site of an archaeological dig. Glynis, you are an artist, but presumably when you are on site, you are there with your archaeological illustrator hat on. What is the role of an archaeological illustrator, particularly in this age of easy photography? And how much of what you are doing is attempting to capture scientific reality, and how much of it is more of an artistic interpretation of what's going on?
That's a good question, and people always ask me that. Why not just photograph these things? And of course, every object that is dug up or discovered is photographed, and but there's a lot you can tell from an illustration or drawing that you cannot tell from a photograph. Say, I find, not me, but the archaeologists find a rim of a cup, a broken cup, and a photograph will make a nice picture of what color it is or if there's any decoration. But with an illustration, I can reconstruct the diameter of the cup, the angle of the rim on the cup, which will tell you what kind of cup it is. It could tell you, in combination with the shape of a rim and the angle, where it's from, and also in a long sequence of time. Certain sites, especially, I liked doing this on Komos, the site in southern Crete that was a Minoan seaport that had a lot of connections with Phoenicians. So that there was a very specific sequence of from levels up to down of time period of certain rim angles changed over slow increments to more straight up, and decorations changed. So my illustrations of these details were very important in defining what level and what relation that level was to other levels and other sites on Crete and all over the Middle East. So it's extremely detail-oriented work, and I measure everything to the millimeter and yes. And
I mean, there's clearly an element of discretion, if not interpretation, involved here in what aspects of something you are choosing to illustrate. Is that a decision that you're making on your own, or are you in consultation with the archaeologists who are digging this up? You know, what are the important things that you need me to capture as an illustrator?
Exactly. So often there on Komos, I would go over every piece with the archaeologist, and he would say, now make sure you have this angle rim at like this, to, you know, this sort of angle. That's what we're looking at, because these are wheel thrown ceramic cups, but they're not perfect. I mean, some of them could be squished on one side, or you know, the break could be right. So it's very fiddly. But recently I've been working at the site of Cancrii in Greece, and that is a Roman port city on the Athens side of Corinth, and there I get free rein. I mean, they say, you know what you're doing, just do it. But and this is a Roman site, so there's entirely different types of vessels, and often they're confusing. So we'll go after I work for a bunch of days, and the archaeologist will check and say, no, I think this is more at this angle, because this is an Eastern sigillata from Syria, so it should look more like this. So I work very closely with the archaeologists in interpreting the vessels.
And are there times when perhaps your perspective as an artist and with your experience, I mean, you're careful to say you're not an archaeologist,
right,
but of course you've been doing this for long enough that you do have your own expertise. Are there times that you perhaps catch details that the archaeologist has overlooked or interpreted in a different way?
Oh, sure. Yes. And I remember one time, especially in Israel, where I had it was some kind of plaster decoration where I think three or four archaeologists looked at it and were trying to fit it together. And I just turned it some way and went click. And the archaeologist grabbed me and gave me a big kiss.
Now, John, you and Glynis, as I understand it, now husband and wife, met on a dig site, or while you were both in the field. But you are an archaeologist who studies music. So what is it that you might be looking for in the field? Are there clues that we can find to ancient music in a dig site?
There are. I'm not a field archaeologist. I mainly do my work in libraries, but things do come out of the ground that relate to music. So we might find in a grave there might be remains of an instrument that was buried with a musician, for instance, or there might be a relief, a votive relief from a sanctuary that has a musical scene on it that might give information about the dimensions of an instrument, or the kind, you know, what kind of instrument it is. There's the same concern with morphology or the shapes of things that Glynis mentioned with respect to pots, we have also with instruments. So let's say a lyre, that's a kind of a harp-like instrument, is found either the remains of a physical instrument or the representation of one on a plaque or in a figurine or some other medium. If I see the shape of the instrument, I have some sense of what period it's from, maybe different geographical affiliations it might have. So yes, the same considerations apply, but in this different sphere. Occasionally, a papyrus with musical notation will come out of a dig site, mostly from Egypt, but sometimes from Greece itself. And these will often have the music notation on them.
So how much of that kind of musical notation do we have? I mean, it's a very small amount that we have at this point.
Yes. So in the latest published collection from Oxford in 2001, there were 66 fragments. And the numbering depends on how you count it. So, for instance, one of these fragments is a vase that shows a trumpeter and has the syllables te, to, ta next to it. So it's clearly an attempt to represent the sound of the trumpet. Does it go beyond that? Some people have argued that te, to, and ta will correspond to different overblows on the trumpet, different bugle tones, if you like. Other people think, no, it's just a rough attempt to represent the sound. So do we call that a fragment of music or not? So the counting varies a little bit. Also, new pieces of music come to light regularly. So as people excavate, and especially in Egypt, in the papyrus dumps of Egypt and other contexts in Egypt, a new fragment of music will come up every few years. So in another 30 or 40 years, we'll need another collection published with all the new finds. Yes.
So with that much controversy over what even constitutes musical notation, how do you, you know, a lot of what you do is trying to reconstruct essentially ancient music. How do you actually go about doing that from those tiny fragments of information?
Well, in the case of, there was a well-defined system of music notation. So when we get a papyrus or an inscription that uses it, it's very clear that that's what it is. And we've known how to convert from that Greek notation to modern notation since the 19th century. So it's always clear, usually clear, when we have a piece of music. Now, if it's a papyrus that has suffered damage in the ground and has holes, maybe at a crease mark or through some other form of damage, then you may be missing some of the musical notation or one of the musical symbols. There may only be half of it, and then you have to and there may be several symbols that will fit the remaining trace that's on the papyrus. Then you get into more interpretive controversies. So let's say, hypothetically, such and such a sign could be interpreted three ways. If it's version A, it'll fall into a different key than if it's version B or version C. And then you often you run up into a wall and you can't progress beyond speculation. In other cases, you may be able to say, well, here's another piece that seems to be from the same century, from the same part of Egypt. It uses a certain sets of notes that seem to indicate the a well-defined mode. If with our new piece we go with option A, it will fit into that familiar pattern. Therefore, it's somewhat more likely to be that interpretation. The danger there, of course, is that you run the risk of leveling the evidence into a smaller number of categories than the reality was, because you're trying to make connections between the few positive pieces of information you have. I mean, what if the note in question is the exception to the rule and is some radically interesting avant-garde note, and you're editing it out of the record by doing this matching to other material.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've actually brought an instrument with you. So tell us a little bit about what this instrument is, who might have used it in the past.
Okay, well, this is a bouzouki. This is the standard instrument now of Greek folk and popular music. It's relatively new in Greece, even. It entered the Greek mainstream in the 1920s with the population exchange with Turkey after the disastrous Greek expedition into Turkey after World War I. I brought it because my ancient replica, which is a kithara, a kind of lyre, was too big to carry in the car with all our luggage. So this is a handy way to perform.
So can you give us a sample of what some ancient Greek music might have sounded like?
Sure. So this is a little selection from a piece which was inscribed on the side of the Athenian treasury at Delphi. We know it was a hymn to Apollo that was literally inscribed with the notation over the words to the hymn. We have another inscription from relating to the same event, telling us who all the performers were, what year it was, 127 BC. It was a sacred mission from Athens to Apollo at Delphi, and they performed this and another hymn. And I'll play you the opening sections of it. It's partially damaged. The stone was broken away, so in some cases the notes are made up. And what the notation tells us is only the notes of the melody. And the rhythm of the music is not specifically notated, but is latent in the meter of the poetry, the long and short syllables. So effectively what we get is like a lead sheet of a jazz tune. We have melody and rhythm. Everything else relating to performance, instruments used, what they might have played under the melody, comes from circumstantial evidence. So I'll play you the first section, and I won't tax you with my singing, just to give you what the tonal information is.
Beautiful. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Now, you know, you're talking about putting this together. We've got some notation. We've got rhythm that we're essentially assuming, I guess, that the notes, the rhythm of the music would line up with the rhythm of the poem.
That's right.
Even in making that sort of assumption, are we perhaps taking the risk that we are making an assumption based on our own, you know, as Joan was mentioning earlier, mm-hmm. kind of imposing our own modern idea of what music and how music and lyrics should line up?
Yes and no. So we know that the in this period and in this style of piece, because the notation is clear on this point, we know that there's one note of melody per syllable of the text. There's a few cases where there's a long syllable and two melodic notes occur, but it's clear because of the way the notation symbols line up over the text symbol. So that much is clear, but there's certain things about the interpretation of ancient rhythm that we're not certain about. So, for instance, was there a pause at the end of a unit of verse, a line of verse? Sometimes we'll have a obvious break in sense. Should we stop there for a while? Was there some instrumental interlude before the song went on that's not represented? So there's that sort of uncertainty. And then, of course, in the case of me playing this on the bouzouki here, my command of the instrument is limited. My sort of experience with playing this comes from, you know, playing Neil Young on the guitar. So I'm sort of strumming it in that sort of way. So all of those sorts of things are interventions on my behalf, which is why I was careful to point out that what is represented in the ancient notation is simply the melody and the rhythm. Everything else I did, I made up.
All right, I'm talking with music archaeologist John Franklin and archaeological illustrator Glynis Fox. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll be rejoined by archaeologist Joan Broughton Connolly. Stay with us. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. We're talking this hour about the archaeology of ancient culture, how we learn about ancient music and theater, and how that can shed light on the culture and social values of ancient people. My guests are Joan Broughton Connolly, professor of classics and art history at New York University, a MacArthur Fellow, and author of The Parthenon Enigma, A New Understanding of the West's Most Iconic Building and the People Who Made It. Also music archaeologist John Franklin, associate professor of classics at the University of Vermont, and Glynis Fox, artist, cartoonist, and archaeological illustrator. She's drawn comic versions of Homeric hymns and published two books about Cypriot archaeology. Now, Glynis, why create cartoon versions of ancient myths? Why this particular style of illustration? And for that matter, why do we need illustrations of these myths at all?
We don't. But it's fun to do them. And I think that I did them really because whenever I read these ancient myths, these very vivid images come to mind. And I think they're very much affected by me having spent time in Greece and in Cyprus and working on different projects and reading a lot. And I can't help but want to bring to life this ancient past in a new way. And I just hearing stories or I can't help but want to draw them. And I think I wanted to explore the form of comics because it's something that's very vivid and rising form in these days. And I had always done comics. And in Cyprus, I while I was working on paintings, I also kept having these funny ideas about the different issues in archaeology. And from spending a lot of time drawing artifacts, they just seemed funny to me. And so I kept drawing these little scenarios.
Now, I have to say, when I first think of comics, the first thing that comes to mind, of course, if you're illustrating, the idea is to illustrate something that you couldn't perhaps photograph. And I tend to think about the comics that are superheroes or more futuristic. Here you're illustrating the past, because that's what we can't see and we can't photograph. And Joan Breton Connolly, this is something that you pointed out earlier, that essentially that's what the ancients were doing as well with their sculpture and with their artwork, was creating images of the past they couldn't see. Do you see kind of a parallel here between between illustrations of ancient myths and what the ancients were themselves doing?
Absolutely. It is the desire to look back and to say, where did I come from and how did my great-great-great-great-grandparents live? What Glynis is doing is so tremendous, in that she is giving access to the ancient past to a whole new generation. And I have to say that her books in Cyprus I have given to my niece and all my nephews, and this is tremendously important to engage the next generation and to give them a way in. As a child out in Ohio, I first was familiarized with Greek myth through beautifully illustrated books. And I have to say, I far preferred them to fairy tales. I'm even talking 4-year-old and 5-year-old. It was those images that artists drew that brought me into a world that I have never left. So the work of an illustrator, of the talent that Glynis has, is absolutely tremendous for the humanities at large, especially at a time when the humanities are under pressure in our universities, etc. We do need to open this work of ancient myth to the broadest possible audience, and I really salute her for what she's doing.
Now, John, you and Glynis have said that one of your first ideas for perhaps working together was to create music videos of ancient music, and that hasn't actually materialized, but I wonder, what was the impetus there? What would illustrations, essentially the visual aspect of this, add to our understanding or our appreciation of ancient music?
Well, I suppose it's an expansion of the point that Glynis and Joan were making, which is it's a way of translating the ancient material into a language with which the current generation is familiar. I would just add briefly to the previous discussion, which is that every time I use Glynis's cartoon versions of the Homeric hymns in class, it's invariably the most successful day of the semester, and she comes in and speaks about it, because the students have read thousands of pages of comics, and it's translating it into a language they know and making it relevant. So in terms of the videos, it would be a way of taking one of the ancient pieces of music, which has words in a foreign language that are inaccessible, so you would have to translate those or give subtitles, but you could illustrate them in a way that was reminiscent of or played against the conventions of modern music videos. So you present them sort of as rock or pop videos. It's another thing I do in my musical remixes, if you like. I use modern software for electronic music and dance music to present these ancient melodies in a way that's will bridge the divide from the present to the past.
Glynis, when you hear the ancient music, does that in any way feedback into your understanding of the myths? Is this a two-way street?
I think then specifically, John did a great song for a Sappho poem that definitely resonates with what the poem looks like to me. I mean, the imagery of the poem. And I don't know, I think of the motifs from Greek vases or figures from Greek vases whirling and dancing. And
right.
Now, John, are there things that we could learn about ancient culture more broadly by learning what their music sounded like?
About ancient culture more broadly? Well, I mean, it gives us, much early poetry in Greece, so Homer and the Sappho, the archaic poets, and even drama, Euripides and so on, was musical. So it And it was a key aspect of these productions. So to take Euripides, for example, students typically read it in a class on myth or drama or literature, and it doesn't come to life in the way that it would if it had its original music. It would be like reading the libretto for a musical without seeing the dance, the costume, the music, and so on. So it's a major part of the spectacular experience that the ancient audience had. So it is, you know, to leave it out is, when especially now when it's possible to include it, is no longer pardonable, I think.
Well, and, you know, there are studies of what different keys, what different rhythms, how they kind of connect with our psychology and why different kinds of music, even, you know, over the past few decades has been popular, what that tells us kind of about the general psyche.
Yes.
The ancient music that you were playing a little while ago is really fairly foreign sounding and,
that's right,
you know, minor keys. And does that, could that tell us anything about how ancients related to music or kind of what their psyche or perspective was on this poetry and on performance?
Yes, it could. I mean, one area that hasn't been looked at much yet to try to connect all the material we have in people like Plato and Aristotle on this very subject, the ethos theory of music, what the Dorian mode, what kind of mood or it induces, or what kind of character formation it's capable of, and trying to connect that with the surviving fragments of music and saying, you know, see, does this piece that we know to be in the Dorian, does it somehow exemplify what Plato and Aristotle tells us about? So, yes, there's a lot to be learned from that still.
Now, you mentioned a little earlier that you do essentially modern remixes. You have this expertise in composition and electronic music. When you are creating a modern remix, what is the goal? Is it simply to create something fun to listen to?
That's as Glenna said with the comics, you know, it's not necessary, but it's fun to do. That's the bottom line. But as I do it, I do think of different strategies for contextualizing the ancient melodies. You know, so if we only have melody and rhythm and you have to supply everything else, you have a choice between just making it up out of whole cloth or of trying to tie it in somehow to the ancient world. So one of the things, for instance, I like to do is find a passage, for instance, Herodotus, that describes a performance, a military band using harps, panpipes, and double oboes and drums. Why not take one of these melodies and use emulations of all those instruments? So then you are hearing a real ancient melody in an impression of an ancient sound environment. Of course, it's not really what it sounded like, but it's a lot closer to what it sounded like than just making it up completely from your head. So I try to remove my voice from the process by putting pieces of ancient information, not just hard musical information, but a historical and cultural contextual information, putting that in there as a sort of a setting for the gem that is the ancient music itself.
Now, Joan Breton Connolly, you talked a little bit earlier about, you know, the impact of modern archaeologists essentially overlaying our modern sensibilities when we're looking at the ancient world. At the same time, you know, you obviously want to maintain interest in the ancients. Do you see a danger in this kind of mixing and melding of the ancient and the modern, or do you see that as a positive progression?
Well, I see it as completely positive. For starters, if we stick only with what is concrete and what comes out of the ground, we lose an awful lot of the complete ancient picture. In an ancient world in which there was no media, no film, photography, internet or television, the centrality of live performance cannot be overstated. So if we tell the story without focusing on live performance, acoustics, movement, the ephemeral, we are presenting an incomplete and false picture. How do we access this?
All right, we're going to have to leave it there. Joan Breton Connolly, John Franklin, Glynis Fox, thank you all so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. You can find links to more of John's music and Glynis's cartoons on our website, capeandislands.org. And of course, you can always find Living Lab Radio on Facebook and Twitter. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.